everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Simply Amazing. Tim Ryder from the Apple. Still in lockout mode, guys. This is getting a little drawn out. I know last time we spoke, the league and the Players Association had just met, and everyone was very upset and offended at what was put on the table as far as the sides. Of course, you know, this all comes down to the owners giving up a fair slice of the pie, and, you know, it's fair business practices season. They might as well get in line. And the players, you know, it's going to come down to them standing strong and holding out for what they've earned. But both sides are expected to meet again on Monday. Personally, I'm not expecting a deal, but I think any progress at this point is probably good. Spring training is around a month away. I believe pitchers and catchers report even less than that. So the clock is ticking. Once that clock begins running out, well, we'll start to see if the league really wants to have a season in 2022. Because, again, this is all the league is the fulcrum point here. If the owners are willing to slice into their bottom lines to properly compensate not only the players as a whole, but young players, young major league ball players who contribute a ton to their respective ball clubs and a lot to the league as a whole, everyone deserves their fair slice. And you can go back and listen to the last episode. We kind of laid out what's out there as far as what the players want, and none of these, I don't even want to call them demands, but suggestions, none of them seem over the edge. None of them seem too much to grasp, but the league is treating that way. And of course, their lackeys in the media are spinning it that way. And, you know, it's a shame that it's going to come down to the league having to really take the hit on me. The players are going to end up taking the hit on this as far as public perception, because they, you know, this is a labor union type thing. You don't just give up ground willingly. You make concessions. If you're willing to make concessions and the other side is not, that should be the focal point. And the league is really not willing to make concessions. It appears that the players are. And on Monday, the players are expected to make a proposal to the league, or a counter proposal, I should say. So we'll get to see exactly what that entails. And I'm sure later in the week you'll hear from us again. And we'll have a little, a little reaction to it and where we are then. Again, I'm not expecting things to get ridiculously drawn out, but I'm not counting it out altogether. Very uneasy times, but we'll learn. We'll know more soon, and we'll discuss that next time. But let's move forward. The Mets announced their international signees this week. Couple of high profile guys. I am not going to pretend to know anything about these players because, one, we don't have a whole lot of information on them. We have some videos that are circulating. They're 16 year old kids. We don't know what they're going to turn into. We don't know. They're being added to the organization based on potential, based on early talents. There's no way to gauge a 16-year-old's future impact as a major league ball player. It's a lot of time before that comes to fruition. But I guess what stands out with me the most is how these teams have deals in place with 16-year-old kids on the low end. Most are 16, 17 years old. On the first day of the signing period, it's just such a crooked system. I'm not going to pretend to know exactly how that works. Ken Rosenthal and Maria Torres. Maria, of course, was a beat writer for the Angels and the Dodgers for a number of years. It's terrific baseball content if you're not following, follow already. But Rosenthal and Maria Torres put together almost an expose into the system, and it really, really harps on the pitfalls of it as a whole. And that's, you know, of course, unfortunately, it's way down on the priority list. The league has so many other pressing matters right now, including the lockout we just discussed. But reform is most certainly needed, and hopefully they'll get to that one day. The Mets also had some news come out on Friday. Most of these guys we already heard about, already reported and or announced, but the Mets have finalized their coaching staff around Buck Showalter. I know we spoke briefly about Heyman's report that Glenn Sherlock was being hired as the bench coach. That has now been officially announced. Of course, Sherlock is a longtime Buck Showalter disciple. So Showalter hired him in Arizona in 1996. He stuck around in Arizona for 19 seasons before coming over to the Mets, actually, in 2016 to be their third base coach. He replaced Tim Tuffle. Stuck around with the Mets until 2019. Went to Pittsburgh to be their run prevention and catching instruction coach. Apparently made quite the impact there. I was reading a few stories from, I guess, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette that, you know, people were very upset that they were leaving. They thought that Sherlock was quite an asset to the staff and, you know, hopefully he brings the same to the Mets. So reuniting him with Showalter should be a good thing. And I guess that also goes for Wayne Kirby. He was with Buck in Baltimore from 2011 to 2018. He'll be coaching first base. He was with Jace Tingler in San Diego in 2019 and 2021. So, you know, Buck knows what these guys bring to the table. Buck knows what they're going to bring to the advancement of his ball club. And I think that's kind of the bottom line. I mean, we were going to talk a little bit more about the coaching staff, but this all comes down to the players. We know that. The coaching staff is the coaching staff. A lot of these, you know, a lot of the decisions that for 100 years were directly on the shoulders of the coaching staff, and a lot of those responsibilities are now, you know, not even redelegated, just spread out and kind of evenly tackled by the organization and front office as a whole. There's a lot of input going into all these decisions, and I think the coaching staff is just there to kind of make sure that these directives and initiatives are being carried out seamlessly from the front office to the players. And, you know, I think that Buck knows where he stands as a manager, and I think that he's bringing in a coaching staff that will also kind of embrace that that responsibility to kind of be the messenger of or carry that message, I should say, from, you know, from the front office to the players and hopefully into action. You know, we talked about Eric Chavez coming over as the hitting coach, Epler guy with the Yankees, with the Angels, very well respected, very much looking forward to that. Jeremy Hefner, he's not a new hire. He's the only incumbent left on the staff. And, you know, we know him. We know what he brings to the table. Very excited to see where he goes with his revamped staff. Joey Cora, we spoke about him. He's very aggressive as a third base coach. I don't want to say got him into trouble with the Pirates last year. We don't know if that was their plan, was to be aggressive, sending guys from home. But Pirates runners were thrown out at home quite a bit. One of the worst teams in the league under Cora's direction at third. But again, with a different direction of coaching or just a different approach, we might see a different type of Joey Cora at third. So who knows how that works out. Craig Bjornsson was named as the team's bullpen coach today. Don't know much about Craig Bjornsson. He was a bullpen coach in Houston and Boston most recently. What stood out to me the most was our buddy Jacob Resnick over at SNY. He posted his team photo from, I want to say, it was from his Houston time. Look up on Jacob's page, you'll see it. And it's, you know, it's not quite Jared Hughes, but what an outstanding photo for a bullpen coach. Just making a silly, I couldn't even describe it. It's a silly face. Please go check it out. And follow Jacob if you haven't, because I'm not the one to tell you about these international guys, but Jacob is. Jacob is all over the minor side. And of course, you remember him. He was our co-host here and couldn't suggest following along more. The Mets also announced they have a new assistant hitting coach, and that would be a gentleman who was already in the organization, Jeremy Barnes, who was the Mets director of player development initiatives. He was a hitting coordinator in Houston for a few seasons before coming over to the Mets. You know, former 11th round pick of the Phillies in 2009, utility infielder, hit 265, 341, 395. Nice on base percentage over four minor league seasons. Looks like he at least his hit tool kind of maxed out at single A, hit 281 there. And then he went over to Australia, where he absolutely raked, hit 329, 398, 499. And again, I believe this is just a guy, kind of a guy who fits the mold of what the Mets are looking for. We were just talking about kind of relaying that information from the analytics department to the players and giving it to them in a digestible way. You know, we've talked about the conduit process before, and you know, it's all kind of a testament to where this team is going. You know, we talked about it at the Apple this week. I had just a little article about Max Scherzer and Jacob deGrom being on the same staff and kind of looking at, you know, Steve Cohen, Sandy Alderson, and Billy Epler. And, you know, they had a vision to kind of leave no doubt in anyone's mind that this is the direction this organization is going. And, you know, they've kind of done all they could this winter and over the last, you know, let's say year, because, you know, the roster wasn't really being addressed, but the front office certainly was. They, I want to say, tripled their analytical department over the last 12 months at least. And you know, Ben Zosmer was in the news this week. The Mets promoted him to assistant general manager last month, I believe. Turns out that was for a reason. The Phillies wanted to interview Zosmer as their to be for their open assistant GM job, and the Mets wouldn't have it. The tables have turned. So, you know, the Brewers, of course, they kept David Stearns from hiring. From interviewing with the Mets a number of times. And, you know, this offseason it happened, I would say, at least half a dozen times where the Mets requested permission to interview somebody and their current employing team denied that request and promoted them internally. And the Mets are finally able to do it from the other side of the table. So Ben Zosmer sticks around. Again, a testament to kind of what's being built here. And, you know, I guess we're already starting to see... You know, of course, the Major League roster has undergone quite the undertaking as far as, you know, just making it ready to actually compete. And now you look to the minors, and guys are starting to bubble up. I know Baseball America came out with their new rankings this week. Francisco Alvarez, number 13. He was number 14 in 2021. He's moved up to number 13 this season. One of the more highly regarded catching prospects in all of baseball. I posted it on my Twitter this week, I believe from his Instagram, which then got to SNY. Anyway, you know how Twitter goes. Shared a video of Alvarez taking batting practice cuts in an indoor cage. I have never seen such a violent swing. And it's not even like, and it's a controlled violent swing. It's totally in control. He has bat speed like Gary Sheffield. I'm not exaggerating. It looked like Gary Sheffield was swinging that bat. It was so quick. Very excited for Francisco Alvarez's future. Brett Beatty jumped up. Is that right? Jumped up from number 52. I thought he jumped up 52 spots. I got to read my own notes here. Jumped up from number 52 to 39. Of course, Brett Beatty, you know, just kept on progressing just tremendously last year. Went from Brooklyn to Double-A Binghamton, went to the Arizona Fall League, and really making his mark. He went from 52 to 39. Ronnie Mauricio dropped 20 spots to number 92. Mark Vientos fell off the list altogether, but now this is where my critique of prospect rankings come into play. You could talk to anyone who knows organizational systems, and they'll each one of them will give you a different list. I mean, there's always going to be consensus ones, consensus one through threes. Seeing Ronnie Mauricio, I know he fell out of a couple of internal, like I guess Mets top 30 and top 10s, falling out of the top two, top three, down to the fifth. I don't agree with that whatsoever. And yeah, he's a bit of a free swinger, but I think we've seen the type of, at least we saw it last year in spring training when he was hitting against, admirable competition. I believe on Baseball Reference, he was like a 7 out of 10 as far as his spring training opposing pitchers. But, you know, this is a kid who's played, I think, an average of 3.5 years below league average at every level he's played at. he's gone on, you know, absolutely ridiculous tears. You know, he has down times, and I think that's part of the whole cat and mouse adjustment that you see with even major leaguers. Until they know exactly who they are and are fully confident in their skills and know kind of how to fend off those attacks from pitchers, kind of changing it up, you know, guys are going to have those ups and downs. And I think that Ronnie Mauricio, just the raw talent, is so extraordinarily through the roof that he's going to find his plane and he's going to take off. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, it's unfair that he's being ranked so low. It's someone's opinion. I have my opinion. They have their, everyone has their opinions. I'm just saying I'm very, very high on Ronnie Mauricio. I think that he will be an impact player at the major league level. And I'm also expecting, an absolutely hellacious year from him on the, in 2022 in the minors. I think that he's now going to come out with a chip on his shoulder. I think that, you know, people are saying he's got no plate discipline. Maybe he puts an effort into waiting for his pitch. Maybe the organization says, hey, we've got too much talent in this kid to let it go to waste with a as a free swinger. Let's try to harness that talent. Let's try to focus it and take it to the next level. That's what this is all about, right? But we shall see. That's all I got for right now. We're going to take a very quick break while I we're going to be talking to Jay Jaffe. You guys know Jay. He's over at Fangraphs, author, author of the Cooperstown Casebook, creator of the Jaws system, which, of course, is featured on Baseball Reference. You guys have seen that around. And also a Baseball Writers of America Association Hall of Fame voter. So you know where this this conversation will be headed. Hang tight. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, and welcome back. As promised, we're back with Fangraphs senior writer, author of the Cooperstown Casebook, and Baseball Writers Association of America Hall of Fame voter, Jay Jaffe. Jay, welcome back to the show, man.
Hey, thanks. Good to be back, Tim.
It's a, I guess the peak of your season right now as the creator of Jaws, which of course focuses on Hall of Fame credentials, mostly focusing on the peak of players, players' careers. You know, it all kind of converges for a holiday season of sorts for you. So I'm sure you're enjoying yourself.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's fun. It's fun that people look to my, you know, look for my input at this point. I have enough different commitments that I actually have to take the time to jot them down and keep track of them, where it's, you know, as opposed to, oh yes, there's that one thing next week. So yeah, it gets a little confusing, but it's fun to, you know, have my thoughts and whatever be in my work, be in demand.
Are you a fan of the, I don't want to say the format that voting has taken in recent years, but I guess, you know, the work that Ryan Thibodeau and his team has done to make this kind of a, a Hall of Fame season. Are you a fan of that? I know there have been some detractors, and I know from a fan perspective, it's, you know, it's cool. It's one of my favorite things of the offseason, and now it's stretched into a 2-month process.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we need 2 months of this. the Hall a few years ago, as recently as 2016, the announcement for the results was on January 6th. Ever since 2017, it's been pushed back about 2 to 3 weeks, and I think that creates a lot of a lot of extra time for people to get sick of the whole circus. and it has its pros and its cons. It's the deadest spot on the baseball calendar. There's just not a lot going on yet. You got, especially right now with a lockout. And I think, I actually spoke to Buster Olney about he wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago that obviously was widely circulated about the draining of the suspense and the prolonged, debates about the Hall election and the process. And I think that there are a number of factors that sort of make it, can make it a more contentious and maybe all encompassing and oppressive than it needs to be. But I think a lot of that is rooted in the particular candidacies of Bonds and Clemens and Schilling, and to a lesser extent, Vizquel, as opposed to being about the process in general, where, there's no consensus on how to handle, the PEDs or the character issues. And we're, these are noisy arguments. And, I think they show that we care about these things. And we care about the Hall of Fame, and we care about the direction it goes. And, I think that's good. I think the transparency, increased transparency and voter accountability are good. But it makes for, a noisy conversation. And if you're not into it, it's a tough time of year.
For sure. It's, it's one thing when there's one lightning rod candidate on the ballot, and, now you've got a handful of them, and then other, whether it's, you want to call them borderline or deserving, but maybe not at first glance guys. And, there's a lot to discuss. Personally, I enjoy it. I know there's a lot of, I guess, kind of rage that can go back and forth on both sides, but I'm sure putting out the content and putting out your ballots for a lot of writers is, maybe a strenuous thing in itself. Cause no one's going to say, oh, it's a perfect ballot. There's always going to be some sort of backlash, but it's exciting. Like you said, it's a really slow part of the off season to begin with. And, it brings a little excitement, but I really did think your ballot was really spot on. I know when you were on the show, this has to be, I don't know, a year ago, 18 months ago, we talked about Bobby Abreu, and I was so thrilled to see him back on your ballot.
Abreu is a guy who, checks a lot of boxes for me. He's a little low in jaws, but he holds up well when you compare him to like a Vlad Guerrero, who got in with 90% of the vote a few years ago. And some of the other, quote unquote, no brainer Hall of Famers that are in, even holds up reasonably well next to Tony Gwynn. And I'm pleased that the traffic has thinned out enough that I've been able to keep him on my ballot. He's a long ways from election, but I think, at least the voters are taking a longer look at him and not dismissing him out of hand. We'll see if that builds into anything. At the very least, I think people, should appreciate his career more than they did based on whatever three All-Star appearances, I think it was, and the power and speed combination that he offered, because, man, that guy could hit. He was a pleasure to watch.
He really was. And I guess from a fan's sight, it's always, oh, was I watching a Hall of Famer? And I guess that's where I get a little hung up. But you look at his numbers and it's like, oh, man, this was just a what a terrific, well-rounded player. But let's go to the top of the list. I guess David Ortiz looks like he's very much on his way. If he doesn't get in this year, it looks like it's going to be very soon. Then you have your three who are kind of, I know it's Scott Rowland. It took a little time for him to get a little momentum, but he's well on his way. He's pushing 70%. Helton and Wagner are two guys. I know we're going to talk about Bonds and Clemens in a second, but Helton and Wagner, they're both on your ballot. They're both, Helton's over it, but Wagner's close to approaching that very important 50% mark. You know, the numbers are deserving. Do you think these guys eventually get enough support?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think you look at what Roland and Helton are doing, the major gains they've made, they're trending towards election. Roland, I think we're probably looking at next year. Helton, maybe a year behind him, maybe 2 years behind him. But I think, you know, once you get past that 50% mark, you know, generally pretty inevitable if you don't have the strong negatives about your case that, that Bonds and Clemens and Schilling do. Wagner, I worry, you know, that he might be running out of time. He's made some major gains, but he started from a very low spot. He's at 48.6% right now, which is only 2 points higher than he had last year. But he has picked up gains from returning voters. And so there may be, you know, he may be a little bit stronger than he looks just because of the different people casting their ballots and reflected in the current percentage than a similar sample from last year. So, I'm optimistic about him getting into the Hall of Fame via one route or another. I don't know that it's guaranteed to be the writers because, like I said, he is in the seventh year of his candidacy. But so he could be a 10th year honoree or maybe just a guy who slips to the era committee.
Possibly. I saw that you included Joe Nathan. And I know, you know, going over the stats, when you put them side by side between him and Wagner and even, you know, put them up against Trevor Hoffman, and they all shared an era together. It's tough to not include Nathan. And I was really intrigued by your inclusion of him.
Yeah. You know, I've gotten away from using kind of the straight off the shelf jaws for relevers and looking more at a version that includes win probability. And now Moore does include a leverage adjustment. But this is a stronger, when you put WPA and WPALI into the mix, what you see is something that I think helps to explain the strong support that Hoffman got, because he's fifth all time in these, what I'll call an experimental version of Jaws called R Jaws, as for reliever, not exactly reinventing the wheel here.
Color me intrigued. I can't wait to see that thing in its final.
Yeah, it's if you see, it's linked in the Nathan. There's tables in the Nathan and Wagner and Papelbon articles, and it's linked. It's now on Baseball Reference. That's the default sort. I have Wagner as being the best reliever outside the Hall of Fame. I have Joe Nathan a hair below twenties and thirties reliever named Firpo Marbury, who did a lot of starting pitching, and that kind of distorts his numbers a bit. But he's sort of an intriguing old time candidate, nonetheless. But Nathan's right below him and kind of on the same tier as Wagner. I had to give his numbers a lot of consideration, and ultimately, especially mindful of where he is electorally, that this is a guy who my vote may make or break, you know, that him getting 5%, I felt compelled to include him. Right now there are only three other people who voted for him. He's at 2.3%. He may not make it. And I'll be disappointed if that's the case, because I think he at the very least deserves a longer look from the electorate. And likewise, I think that's true for Jonathan Papelbon as well, who I wrote about yesterday. And, you know, Papelbon's a bit of a character and kind of wearying. There was a reason I left until the last candidate on my list. But at the same time, the guy had a really strong decade as a closer, and put up some strong numbers that place him in the top 10 in that stat. So, I wouldn't mind if he got the longer look as well, the same courtesy, but right now he's got exactly one vote, from the 175 in a tracker. So that seems even less likely than Nathan. And maybe these guys will look different. Their candidacies will look different in 10 years if we see how hard it is for guys like Greg Kimbrell and Kenley Jansen and Aroldis Chapman to sustain what they've started, because They're kind of the next wave of guys. And I don't know that they'll necessarily surpass Wagner and Nathan and even Papelbon.
Yeah, no. And the reliever is just such a volatile spot. And when you see that sort of consistency, it's, you almost have to take notice. And then once you see that, the elite production with the consistency, it sets guys apart. And yeah, I'm with you. I hope that Nathan gets his fair shake. Now, the dynamic of the next group of guys I'm going to talk about, it's kind of like it's almost like a little waterfall. So we spoke about Ortiz. He's leading the way. His, let's say it, an alleged positive test, which everyone thinks is a solid source of information, was in 2003. It was anonymous, of course, and it was before the league implemented their rules. It looks like voters have kindly reflected on that, and especially this scenario, and like I guess the uniqueness of itself. Of course, Bonds and Clemens last year on the ballot, they're both at, you know, just above 75%, but as more ballots come in, that could very well change. It's a discussion in itself. But you look at guys like A-Rod and Manny Ramirez, who were both popped for PEDs well after MLB had implemented rules. Manny's at 37% and change. A-Rod is just over 40%. Do you feel that the timing of these positive tests, or in Ortiz's case, an alleged positive test, I mean, well, Clemens and Bonds, you know, nothing truly concrete, but a whole lot of speculation. I guess maybe in Clemens' case, a little bit tougher. Again, different conversation. Do you think that those lines kind of get blurred as time goes on, or for specifically in time for Ramirez and A-Rod?
It depends. I mean, it depends who you're asking. I mean, you know, there's no consensus, you know, strong consensus within the electorate that there's no one size fits all here, because these guys all have kind of different cases. You know, my line is that anything that happened before, you know, testing and penalties were in place, which is to say starting in 2004, belongs in one category, and everything that happened from 2004 onward is a second category. Now, I think, you know, I think we can go beyond saying that there's speculation about Bonds and Clemens. There's a lot of evidence that these guys used, you know, and it's just that when they were using, Major League Baseball did not have a penalty in place. And, you know, what we had instead was a complete institutional failure that involved the commissioner, the owners, the players' union.
Oh my goodness!
their peers, the media, and, you know, and even the fans who kept cheering. I mean, look, the BBWAA gave Barry Bonds 7 MVP awards, and some of those came after it was revealed that he was part of the Balco sweep. So, sure. You know, it's, I mean, it's kind of crazy,
I guess I should have said a lack of positive tests. There was plenty.
Yeah, it's, you know, and there's you know, and meanwhile, on the other side of it, you've got, you know, Manny Ramirez and Alex Rodriguez, who not only were, reported as testing positive in the survey tests, but also later got popped, you know, Ramirez twice, A-Rod once, for violations of the drug policy. I left both of those guys off of my ballot on that basis, whereas I included Bonds and Clemens, on my ballot. Ortiz, it's the survey test. So again, I don't hold that against him. There was some interesting stuff said by Rob Manfred, essentially waving off the value of the survey test and that report. It seemed like it was specific to Ortiz when he said it, but I think it should be taken more generally that shouldn't be, you know, something that is a deal breaker unto itself. And I don't think we've really seen it used as that, except for Sammy Sosa, you know, because it sort of fits into this, you know, stereotype and whatever that you know, presumption of guilt on Sammy's part that's, you know, based on his body type and, you know, not unreasonably so, given what we've seen from others who have been more concretely identified as PED users. So I don't think there's a blanket, you know, there's no blanket solution there for voters. And I think they've voted, you know, to some degree, they've all been evaluated based on the nuances of their cases. And that's why Bonds and Clemens are closer to election, and why Ortiz is probably going to get in, if not this year, the next year. And why Manny is particularly hosed. And I think, you know, A-Rod's probably hosed too.
Yeah. I want to ask you about two guys who did make your ballot and who have gotten a lot of support, I guess additional support in recent years, Andrew Jones and Gary Sheffield. Gary Sheffield, I think, at least personally, I think he kind of gets caught up in the era. Of course, he made your ballot, and I'm very curious to hear your reasoning. Of course, it was in your Fangraphs piece, but for the listeners, it's I think it's a shame how some guys get overshadowed because of the timing of their careers. And, you know, Andrew Jones. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, Sheffield was, there's no doubt Gary Sheffield was an elite hitter. His defensive numbers knock him down significantly in WAR and JAWS. It's fair to wonder the extent to which those are, you know, they're such outliers that it's almost seems hyperbolic. You know, and the fact that he didn't have the DH slot available to him for most of his career, I think, you know, I think we could be a little bit more charitable. I think we could also understand how badly the Brewers mistreated him and, during the outset of his career. And, you know, I think that this is a guy who was clearly an elite hitter. And, you know, again, he was named in the Balco case. His explanation actually seemed kind of plausible that he didn't know what he was taking. And as soon as he found out that it was a PED, he stopped working out with Bonds. You know, this is Tom Verducci's reporting, not mine here. So, you know, and Verducci's generally pretty hard line about that stuff, but seemed pretty forgiving when he wrote about Sheffield. Likewise, the story about the intentional errors seems to be rather apocryphal. I've researched it. Verducci researched it. If it happened, it happened in the minor leagues. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of hyperbole there. You know, he was one of my favorite players to watch hit. And, you know, I found room for him on my ballot. He wasn't a slam dunk, but he was a guy that was like, oh, okay, I have room here. I can do this. I'd rather do this than, you know, Sammy Sosa at this point.
Yeah.
Because I think he's actually legitimately got a chance, and we've seen his share grow. Andrew Jones rates as the best center fielder of all time by Baseball Reference's version of WAR. A bit ahead of Willie Mays.
That blows my mind. Maybe every time I hear it blows my mind.
Yeah, there's maybe some gray area in there. Chris Dial, who has a defensive system that is used in the Gold Gloves voting called RED, points out that some of Jones's numbers may be inflated a bit by, you know, the so-called discretionary fielding plays, the ones that, you know, either he or the left fielder could have gotten it, but he took all those chances away from his neighbors. That's something you see in fielding stats anyway, but that may have distorted his numbers a bit. I don't know. I still have him as the in the top dozen in JAWS, a very high peak. Yes, he, you know, his career faded out early, but even with that, his peak is well above Hall standard. And, you know, somebody had to, you know, when you think about the fact that Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, and John Smoltz are all in the Hall of Fame, and that of those three, only Smoltz was really a strikeout pitcher. You know, Andrew Jones was the key defender for the Braves dynasty. Those runs went to die somewhere, and a lot of them went to die in Andrew Jones's glove. And so, you know, I think he's rightly being recognized as a Hall worthy candidate. We're seeing him. He was in the single digits for the first couple of years, and now he's pushing almost 50% here in the published ballot so far.
I love that. I love that about today's the process of today. It's if a guy catches momentum with the public now, and now it's actually visible. It's not just, you know, newspapers and word of mouth amongst fans. Guy catches, becomes viral, maybe you should say it. Let's look at a Wagner. Let's look at a, you know, at Andrew Jones. And boom, they just, you know, t- to the moon and then see if they, you know, see if they land. It's very cool. But Jay, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us, man. This has been great.
Glad you enjoyed it. Happy to share my work with your audience and look, I'm honored that people value my work in this area and others. And it's fun to talk about this stuff.
Oh, it's great, man. And everyone, if you haven't checked out Jay's book, The Cooperstown Casebook, I'm going to link it in the description. Click on the link there. I highly suggest it. It's a great book. And we're all eagerly awaiting part two, Jay.
All right. Thanks. Thanks a lot, Tim.
All right, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care.
All right, everybody. We will speak to you next time. You know the sign off. Let's fucking go, Mets. We'll see you next time. Later.